When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
From New York City, this is Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit. I'm Matt Singer.
And I'm Allison Wilmore.
And I'm Stacy.
And I'm Virginia.
And I'm the governor. And on this week's SVU, all of us are going to review M. Night Shyamalan's Split.
Ladies, so nice to see all of you. But I'm going to have to ask you to keep the beast out of the light for the remainder of the show. Later in this episode, we'll bring you Cue Shots, where we recommend some movies you can rent or stream at home right now, all with a common theme. And we were of at least 24 different minds about what to make our theme this week. Multiple personality movies was certainly an option. M. Night Shyamalan, his oeuvre, his career would have been great, but none of his films are available to stream right now on any of the major sites. So instead, we are going to talk about unconventional superhero movies and TV shows, a subject I know nothing about, so I'm going to have to do some fast research.
You hate those superheroes.
I hate superheroes. Yeah, it's going to be rough. But first, let's do Opening Break, a segment we do in conjunction with Movies on Demand on Cable, in which we spotlight a few titles that are new on demand. Allison, what have you got for us this time?
Well, first up, new on demand on May 16th. Triple X, Return of Xander Cage. Yeah, I have to say, of all of the unasked for sequels that have come our way over the last year or so, in theory, Vin Diesel reprising his extreme sports dude turned government operative 12 years after the last movie performed not that well seems like peak, really. But did I miss this in theaters? And do I want to see Vin Diesel ski through a jungle and ride a motorcycle on the ocean? Yes. Yes, I do. The elements don't matter to Xander Cage, and they don't matter to me.
No.
That is on demand on May 16th. On demand on May 19th is a movie I've heard very little about, but that's actually was well received when it had its premiere. It is The Survivalist. Have you heard of this movie, Matt?
I have heard the title, but remind me what it's about. Is it about a survivalist?
It is, okay, in good. A post-apocalyptic setting.
Right.
It's a British science fiction kind of thriller directed by Stephen Fingleton and starring Mia Goth of most recently A Cure for Wellness and Martin McCann.
Right.
Yes. He plays a survivalist who I don't think ever gets a name, who is living in the wilderness when two women, one of them Mia Goth, come across his settlement and kind of try and bargain with him in order to stay in a world now where most of the population has died off and there are raiders going around who have no problem killing you for your food.
Right.
I've heard this has some Mad Max vibes, though I feel like you can't have Mad Max vibes without cars.
Yeah.
That said,
sort of important.
I appreciate what the sentiment behind that. I do like those vibes anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So that is The Survivalist, and it will be on demand on May 19th. Finally, on demand on May 23rd, My Life as a Zucchini. This is another one of those non-Disney, non-Pixar, non-DreamWorks, non-American animated movies that gets nominated for Best Animated Film at the Oscars every year. And you always think they look lovely in the clips, and then you don't get around to seeing them. It's funny, the divide in that category is starker than I think any other, just in terms of the size of certain movies versus
right.
others.
I think they changed the rules, though. So next year, starting next year, it may not be the case.
Well, I will say you should see this movie.
Okay.
It is a Swiss-French co-production, and it uses cute bright stop motion to tell a story with some seriously dark themes. It's about a boy who is accidentally responsible for the death of his abusive alcoholic mother and gets brought to a group home with other children who have their own troubling stories. And it is about how he eventually kind of makes friends there and makes a new home for himself amongst all these children who come from sometimes, you know, dark backgrounds. It's surprisingly sweet while also tackling ambitious themes. That is My Life as a Zucchini, and it will be on demand on May 23rd.
To whom am I speaking with now?
Dr. Fletcher, it's Barry.
It doesn't seem like Barry. Barry is an extroverted leader.
Yes, I am.
I'm going to take a professional guess based on the description of all 23 identities that live in Kevin's body that I've gotten from Barry. I think I'm talking to Dennis. I'm encouraged we can finally meet. And I've guessed this because you've adjusted the chocolate dish twice since you came in here, and I understand you have OCD.
I see. Now I see. That's clever. That's clever. But I'm not Dennis.
The main review on every episode of Film Spotting SVU is chosen by listeners through a poll on our newly redesigned website. Check it out, filmspottingsvu.com. In this poll, your choices were Split, the latest and most successful film in quite a while by M. Night Shyamalan, the unusual documentary casting JonBenet, and the biopic Neruda from Pablo Larraine. And that was the order in which they placed, with Split earning a decisive victory with over 51% of the vote. The film is the second in a new phase of Shyamalan's career, I would say, sort of more back-to-basics, stripped-down, smaller thrillers. After a largely, some might even say wildly unsuccessful period where he tried his hand at making big-budget blockbuster films like The Last Airbender and, God help us, After Earth, Split more closely recalls the earlier films that made M. Night Shyamalan a household name. And it was his biggest hit in many years. It made about as much money as The Last Airbender on less than a tenth of that film's budget.
That's impressive.
That is very impressive, actually. And I guess it helps when you have one guy playing most of the characters. That saves some money. That would be James McAvoy as Kevin. He is a man suffering from dissociative identity disorder. And amongst his many personalities, there's Dennis, who has obsessive-compulsive disorder. And there's Hedwig, who's very childlike. And in conversation with his therapist, Dr. Fletcher, who's paid by Betty Buckley, there is discussion of this 24th mysterious personality called the Beast. It made me think of Seinfeld a lot. Do you remember the episode of Seinfeld with the Beast?
I do not.
That was what they called the stinky car, the B.O. and the stinky car. It's the Beast! So that was a problem for me, personally. I don't know if anyone else had that. But anyway, the Beast, yes. And with Kevin's personalities fighting for control, some of them believe that they can then transform themselves into this beast, something more than an ordinary man. But to bring out this beast, they need to commit an act of human sacrifice. And so they kidnap three teenage girls, including Anya Taylor-Joy's Casey, and lock them up in a basement. It's up to the young women to find their way out before they become fodder for this horrible, I don't know what you would call it, experiment. I'm not quite sure. As we already mentioned, this was very much a comeback for Shyamalan. On a tiny $9 million budget, the film has made $275 million worldwide. That is impressive. And it was his best reviewed movie as well since Signs 15 years ago, at least according to Rotten Tomatoes. So my simple question for you, Allison, is, are you on board the hype train with Split, or are you having second thoughts? Or third or fourth or 24th thoughts about this thriller?
I enjoyed this more than I thought I would. Mm-hmm. Honestly, it was one I missed that when it was coming out in theaters, because I believe it came out around the Sundance Film Festival.
Yeah,
it was
away, the week of, I
the
think.
The week of. And the trailer had not sold me. I think that you see James McAvoy, you see a lot of him doing the personalities, and it doesn't really give you the ramp up that the movie does in kind of easing you into exactly how his character works. So I had not expected much from this. And I will say, I think its aims are fairly modest. Its scale is modest. And I feel like it fulfilled everything it kind of aimed for. It was, I think especially with what happens at the end and the kind of place it sets for itself, do we consider this a spoiler? You managed to stay unspoiled
for a while until the... Well, I don't want to spoil. We can talk about it later. Yes. I think we should talk non-spoilery for a while, okay, and then we'll go full spoiler.
Okay, I will say that the context that that gave made me like the movie. I think made me understand what it was going for.
Yeah.
In way, you know, as opposed to just looking at it as a thriller, to look at it as kind of an origin story for James McAvoy's character, I think worked really well, actually.
Yeah.
I don't think that if you look at it as in any way a thriller that attempts to depict mental illness as even vaguely realistic, much less like dissociative identity disorder, which is a highly debated very little consensus in the psychiatric community kind of disorder, and that almost certainly does not ever work the way it does in movies, where people have very cleanly drawn personalities.
Right.
It is an extremely movie version of mental illness that almost isn't. It has almost no bearing to what actual mental illness is like at all. I think as long as you can kind of accept that, and I think the kind of context it places this in helps that. I think that, yeah, it worked for me. You know, it was a reminder for me that Shyamalan has a really good sense of space, that he is good with the camera. He is good with kind of how he moves the camera through space. It made me remember that I have liked him a lot as a director.
Mm-hmm.
But how about you?
It's funny. I think we pretty much agree in a lot of ways, but I think I didn't like it quite as much as you. And a lot of it has to do with that ending, which we won't spoil yet. We'll get to it. And how you were saying, like, it kind of reframes the movie. And I guess my issue was the movie that it sort of reveals itself to be, I felt like I would rather see just that movie. It's like, it almost feels like a coming attraction for a more interesting movie in a way, in that this movie is largely, you know, it's almost like, certainly in setup, I don't think in execution it's quite that, but it's almost the setup of like a torture porn film in terms of, you know, these women are trapped and can they escape and this guy is threatening them. And in, like all of that stuff I found pretty unconvincing, uninteresting. I didn't even find it that scary. Like, I don't think it works all that well as like a horror movie, even though that's ostensibly what it is. I agree that sort of like when it unfolds at the end, you go, oh, this is what it really is. It works better as that. And like the stuff about Kevin and all of his personalities, while I do not think it in any way reflects a realistic depiction of mental illness or even this particular illness, I thought McAvoy was great. I thought all the voices and the physicality that he brings to it was really impressive and fun. And his scenes with the therapist and the therapist character, who's sort of both very kind of, you know, it's interesting to hear her talk about his illness, but also she kind of is... She's not quite as smart as she thinks she is, or she's at least a little out of her depth, essentially. She's like underestimating him and his kind of craziness. I liked all of that. But I just thought like the details and the specificity of like where they're trapped and are they going to get out? And like, I didn't really find there was much attention to that in terms of the details. And I wasn't entirely convinced by it. And it didn't, I don't think Shyamalan really cared about it either, which is sort of the proof of that is sort of the ending, which is like much less about that than it is about this other thing.
Yeah. I suppose for me, it felt more like a very dark character study than it did. I never even kind of really took it as a thriller, as a kind of kidnapping thriller, though I mean that it undeniably is.
Yeah.
You know, I think I did appreciate that that having the three characters, it took time to at least have the characters feel like three different, Anya Taylor-Joy is obviously the main character of the movie along with McAvoy, but the other two girls didn't just feel like bodies like that were there to be, you know, like they had a friendship dynamic that Anya Taylor-Joy did not fit into.
Yeah.
They made active attempts to escape that I thought.
Yeah, I guess.
I mean, I feel like that there are a lot of times where movies that are about captivity are often just about, you know, like the women are just like these bodies that are kept, you know, in spaces. And I think that the movie at least tried to make them act like active parties in this.
I'm making a face at you.
Well, the movie certainly
I guess. I mean, the movie certainly makes Anya Taylor-Joy's character the main character. And mm-hmm. I think maybe that's part of the problem is like, really, Kevin should be the main character in this movie in a sense.
I think they get equal screen time, I suppose.
Maybe they do. But we don't get any... Do we get any flashbacks? I don't think so. To Kevin's life? I mean, like,
see one of him under the bed.
Oh, right.
But, I mean, you see him outside of the space.
Yes, which I think deflate. I mean, in a way, those scenes are great, but they also deflate the tension.
Absolutely.
And so, I guess you're right in the sense that if you're going to say, well, this isn't really that kind of thriller, then that's not a problem. If you're trying to get invested more in the entrapment angle, that doesn't help. I just, you know, I think that she... Even though we see these flashbacks, and there is sort of like a, you know, they're sort of important to the ending in terms of when there's this final confrontation, the way that it ends, as you know, it only makes sense with those flashbacks, I guess. But I don't think we really learned all that much. I didn't really think those flashbacks really that were all that interesting or added a ton. Whereas I was perpetually more interested with Kevin and was always interested to learn more about him. And so it's like, again, it's like getting to what the movie is getting at eventually. It's like he really should be the focal point. And the movie sort of splits it. And the split to me feels uneven in terms of who I care about or who I'm interested in. Where I didn't really care that much about. And again, it's all should all be about, are these women going to get out of here? And I didn't really find myself all that invested in that. Where I was much more interested in just like, is the therapist going to discover what's going on? Is Kevin going to have an even more of a breakdown? Is the beast real? All these sorts of things. I found that much more interesting.
Well, sure. I mean, they are basically like vehicles into his story, right?
Yeah.
Like, we can accept that. Like, we see almost nothing of what their lives are like before this. We understand only that they're not really friends with Anya Taylor-Joy's character. She doesn't really have any friends, right? And then they are immediately swept up into someone else's world,
right?
At this hugely dangerous transition point,
right?
I mean, I can understand that feeling frustrating as a way to get to the story, but I also feel like, I mean, this is basically following the tracks of another story that basically feels like a prequel, you know, in a way. Like, is another it follows in the path of in the tradition of another origin story. So I was spoiled on that long, long ago. Mm. And so that clearly also determined how I saw the movie.
Yeah. I mean, to me, it's like, like you were saying that this showed you that, you know, Shyamalan, he can be a good director. And I think he can. To me, it's like it in some ways exhibits both the best and worst of his impulses. Like, moment to moment, he's a very gifted filmmaker in framing and editing and
camera movement.
Well,
and also, I mean, given that, like, you know, this is a relatively low budget movie. A lot of it takes place in one set of rooms,
yes,
right?
Yes.
And that you get a real sense of the space. Mm-hmm. And he likes to kind of track around a room and like down that hallway,
right,
in ways that really emphasize how the space is connected and also how little of it there is.
That's all true. But what I was also going to say was that, you know, it doesn't build to a conventional, like, he was dead all along twist. I think what we're alluding to, and which we should probably just get to in a minute anyway, that the ending, it does sort of feel like a, you know, like I've been withholding or just sort of like shifting focus or kind of keeping my cards close to my vest to reveal this thing at the end of the movie, where it's like, and it's effective. It's like a moment of, okay, yeah. But, I, you know, it's one of those things where you feel like, well, if you had just sort of made this, if you just told us this story straight, this is just basically like an origin story for this character, it might have been a more interesting movie to me, you know, without all the, because if it's not going to be a real, truly a thriller, if the thriller is kind of just like a sleight of hand trick to hide what you're ultimately doing, just do what you ultimately want to do. Just make the most interesting character the main character. I'm not, I know that's not who he is. Like, that goes against everything he believes in as a director. But I don't know. I feel like I might like that movie better.
Yeah, I see. It didn't bother me that it split the difference between, between him and...
I can't believe you said that. It didn't split the difference.
I mean, it's basically how the movie's structured, right? It's just demanding you split your attention between the victim and the perpetrator slash other victim.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, I mean, you kind of needed this character. You needed her character to allow you that sense of sympathy for his, mm-hmm. right? To have the idea that they have abuse in common, that his like kind of warped idea of the world and what true, you know, true fulfillment and true humanity is. I think that I liked, as frustrating as you found those flashbacks, I felt like that build was like in a pulpy way, totally good and earned mm-hmm. to her, to their kind of like matched moment of having come from scarring, right. literally scarring in her case,
right.
childhoods.
All right, should we talk about the ending more?
Stop beating around the bush here. Very awkwardly.
Yes. All right, so here we go. Spoilers are starting right now. If you don't want to know, just fast forward a couple minutes. And yeah, so the sort of revelation at the end is that this character, Kevin, is essentially like a supervillain. It's the origin of a supervillain, essentially, and that he exists in the same world as the character from Unbreakable, another M. Night Shyamalan movie. And that movie, it was, I think, what you were talking about in terms of origin stories. Like, that movie, it looked from the surface just like a weird Shyamalan movie. It was the movie he made after Sixth Sense. You were like, what is going on? And then by the end of the movie, you realized sort of very cleverly he had created a superhero without you realizing it, which I haven't seen that movie in a long time, but I really liked that movie when it came out. And so this is sort of like the mirror image of that. Instead of a superhero, you've watched the origin story of a supervillain who even gets a name at the end of the movie. He's the Horde. The Horde, which, yeah, it's not a bad supervillain name.
Oh, it could be worse.
Right. And we see Bruce Willis looking, I thought, very haggard. Like, the years of superheroing.
Very faded.
Yeah, the years of superheroing for poor David Dunn, his character, have not been kind, I guess.
Hard on a guy.
Hard on a guy to be a superhero for the last 15 years or whatever. And that, and we also now know that they are making a sort of joined sequel between the two, which I guess will be interesting. I'm not quite sure how that's going to work. But yeah, so that was the ending, which you, I guess, knew all along that was the twist.
Yes.
I had heard rumblings that there was some kind of twist. I didn't really know what it was until, M. Night Shyamalan was like tweeting last week, happy to announce the joint Unbreakable and Split sequel called Glass, which was the name of Samuel L. Jackson's character in the previous movie. So yeah, I don't know what else you want to say about it. I mean, do you want to see the continuing adventures of the Horde versus David Dunn?
You know, I feel like and we can talk about this in the next section, I certainly have a sense of exhaustion with the superhero genre. That said, I do like Unbreakable and I like Split as superhero stories that kind of. That took place entirely before any superheroic action, functionally, you know, or supervillain action, like until this point. The thing that I always feel that I am starved for in watching superhero stories is, actual character development and actual downtime, which is both of those movies are filled with, mm-hmm. I think that it is way less interesting to me when someone is then embarking on a path of like wreaking havoc or saving the world. Like, that part is the least interesting part of the story.
Mm-hmm.
I know mm-hmm. that it enables the action, but it's so easy not to care in right. so many of those movies. So I feel like having a movie that was just about the kind of really tortured psyche of this future supervillain, and having a movie that was about the reluctant heroism of a normal guy who realizes slowly that he has this power.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's an approach I really enjoy.
Yeah. And it's funny because we see so many origin stories in more conventional superhero movies. But
Batman's parents die?
Right, exactly.
Ben die.
Yes, absolutely. But I will give Shyamalan credit that he makes his versions of that feel a lot fresher and more interesting and much more grounded in characters and people. I do wonder, because I did like Unbreakable a lot, and I haven't seen it in a long time, so who knows what I would think now, but generally I would say I think that that's a better movie than this, and I wonder if that's because, when you're making it about a superhero and generally like a good guy, you can make a movie about this character and be like, oh, it just turned out to be a superhero movie, you didn't realize it all along, whereas with Kevin and with the Horde, I almost wonder if he was like, well, I can't just make him the main character because he's the bad guy or whatever. Like, there needs to be a character to root for or something. And maybe that's why he made this story, so that we do have this, quote-unquote, this heroine, this character to sort of latch onto, to root for. But I just kind of wonder if there is a way to make an even more interesting movie where the bad guy, quote-unquote, obviously he's much more complicated than that, but that that character could be the total focus.
I just feel like with a, with the way the character is set up, you have to see him from an outside perspective because all of his conflict is otherwise internal. Like, do you want to see a bunch of James McAvoy sitting in a room that represents his psyche?
I kind of do.
Fighting for like a light?
Why not?
I definitely do not.
See, oh, we agree. We disagree there. I feel like that could be kind of great.
Yeah, I know. It sounds like a nightmare acting exercise and I do not want to see it.
I liked seeing all the different James McAvoys here, and if you don't want to see that, I have bad news for you because I almost guarantee that there'll be a scene like that.
I don't mind the different James McAvoys. I do not want a room full of them together.
You don't think that scene will be in Glass, that scene like that?
I certainly won't be the whole movie the way you're kind of requesting.
I don't need the whole movie, but
you want a lot of it.
This
you
would be an interesting wager. This would be an interesting wager to see. Will we get that scene in Glass?
I can't tell if I think that it will be there or not. I hope not.
I don't know. All right. Well, we'll find out whenever that movie comes out. It's coming in the next couple of years. It's headed our way. In the meantime, this was Split. It is available now for rent.
The world will understand now. The beast is real.
He's done awful things to people, and he'll do awful things to you.
You may have noticed that people have been watching a lot of superhero movies recently.
Have they?
That maybe the superhero movie has become a major box office force.
Has it?
I know. It's shocking, but somehow the dominant genre of our moment seems to be superhero.
It feels kind of like a Twilight Zone episode where, like, you know, like a kid, 13-year-old kid, let's just call him Matt, just pick a name at random. You know, he's a shy nerd, you know, and he's just wishing, someday I wish I could see Spider-Man in a movie. And maybe people would not make fun of me for liking comic books.
And then ironic punishment is you will see so many Spider-Men.
Yes. Yeah, do you remember the episode of The Simpsons? I think it was a Treehouse of Horror where Homer's like the donuts are being shoved down his mouth.
Absolutely.
I kind of feel like that some days.
Yes.
The donuts are
have all the superhero movies.
Except he enjoyed it. And there are times where I don't enjoy all the donuts.
Yes.
It's a lot of donuts.
They do. Well, I feel like you often see, because these movies are so expensive, the mainstream ones are so expensive and they have to be exported. They have to really play large internationally to even make a profit. These movies are big. They can only go big.
Yeah.
They can only shop spectacle around.
Yes.
And that tends to get kind of exhausting.
It gets repetitive. It gets a little tiresome. Yeah, they all blend together. I mean, by their nature, now they try to make them blend together. And that can yield some, and I'm still a dork who loves this stuff at heart. I was reading some comics last night before I went to sleep. So it's not like I can't find pleasure in these movies. Guardians of the Galaxy, I thought was a lot of fun. I enjoyed it. And it's fun when they have the cute little moments that connect everything. But you're right. The bigger they are, the broader they have to go, and sort of the less interesting, generally speaking, they're allowed to be.
Yeah, I still enjoy a lot of them as entertainment, but certainly you get that feeling. You're only watching the big events, or you're only watching like a season finale over and over and over again.
Yes.
Yeah.
There is a weird thing where, and I've been thinking about this, something I'm working on writing something about. It's like, you know, movies now, it's every, like you're saying, spectacle. We have to get, how are we going to differentiate ourselves from television? Well, visual, spectacle, bigness. We go big. And yet, what do they end up making by making all these things connect? It feels like it's like a TV show you go to the movies to watch. It's a strange thing. Like, and if they're trying to make them all feel special and unique and worth getting out of your house and going to the movie theater for, but they all kind of look alike and they connect together and they end up being basically a TV show.
Just a slow, expensive TV show.
Right. It's a really expensive TV show that you have to wait 2 years in between each installment.
Yeah.
Which is not necessarily in an age of instantaneous, you know, binge watch culture. I don't know if that's going to work out in the long term. I really don't.
I'm curious. But so we wanted to talk about unconventional superhero stories here. Stories that either in movie or TV form attempted to parody or subvert or rewrite the very codified rhythms of some of these stories, whether they are looking at downtime, superhero downtime, or looking at someone with delusions of being the superhero. There are certainly some of those.
There could be no big blue lights in the sky
on
this list. No one can
fight a big blue light in the sky.
No portals that need to be closed by people working together. Ixnay on that, on our choices today.
Yes.
That is not allowed.
Is there room for an indie superhero movie or a kind
with
of
a
like,
portal in the sky?
Or anything. Like, do you think that this is a genre that can really still have space for things that... I mean, I guess Split is an attempt to get at that, a $9 million movie.
And it was a huge hit. It was a really successful... It's like one of the biggest success stories of the year. I guess that and Get Out would be the two big success stories in terms of non-gigantic superhero movies so far. So apparently it can, as long as it's like a very... like a horror film with a high concept also. As long as you can make anything into a high concept horror movie, you're good. You're golden. All right, who wants to go first here? You want me to start?
Why don't you start?
All right. Well, one thing that almost all conventional superhero stories do or have, no matter the medium, no matter the company or the, you know, that they're based on or the characters that are the focus, is that that focus is usually the superhero. You know, makes sense, I guess, that he or she is the one who's front and center. And very little attention. You were kind of talking about this in our Split review. It's like there's very little attention paid to the ordinary people that live in this universe. You know, the people around them, the impact that superheroes have on their lives. You know, I guess if you're like best friends with a superhero or like Superman just happens to like work at the desk next to you at the newspaper, we're going to learn about you. Like your life will be affected and we'll get to see that. But if you're just an ordinary person working a regular job and you don't have any direct connection to the world of superheroes, you are basically invisible in these stories. And in some of these movies, it's pretty clear like no consideration is given to you as you and thousands of your fellow metropolisians, let's say, are slaughtered off camera or just out of frame. And personally, I think this is one of the, like, even though we have so many superhero stories right now, I think this is like the most interesting and unexamined part of these stories is that you don't see this very much. How does the existence of a Superman or the X-Men impact a regular person? And there have been a few comics throughout the years to sort of explore this idea. And some of them, like one that I like in particular is this Marvel comic called Damage Control, which is about a company that cleans up after superhero fights. They can be really good, but almost all of them have been canceled very quickly. None of them have been...
No one wants that.
No one wants it. Right. People go, oh, that's a great idea, and then no one buys it. And ironically, that's exactly what happened to my first pick, the DC television series Powerless, which just ran for a couple of episodes this year on NBC. It is basically a workplace comedy like The Office, with the twist being that it is set in the world of the DC universe and that these characters' lives are indirectly affected by the presence of DC heroes and villains. In the first episode, the main character Emily, who's played by Vanessa Hudgens, her train to work on her first day is literally knocked off the track by a battle between Crimson Fox and Jack-O-Lantern. So, you know, very minor characters. You don't see Batman show up, but you do see his cousin, Van Wayne, the cousin of Bruce Wayne, who's played by Alan Tudyk, who's really, really funny on this show, supposedly is Bruce's cousin. I can't say for certain, but I don't think in the comics he has a cousin, Bruce's family. I don't think he has any family in the comics.
He doesn't have a sprawling family.
Right, asking him
more
for money.
Distant,
that
relative.
Might be a good idea for a character.
I would love that, actually.
And it is a funny idea for the show, this idea that, you know, the most selfless, the most self-destructive hero that'll do anything to save the world has this just jerk, selfish jerk of a relative working for his company. Van Wayne. I like that a lot. The other employees at this office include Danny Pudi from Community. He's really funny on it as well. And like a lot of mainstream superhero stories, Powerless uses these ideas, these character ideas as an allegory. In this case, it is, you know, the title basically gives it away. Just the idea that you are a worker drone at a faceless company going to your job day after day, you can feel pretty powerless. And I watched a couple of episodes. I had not seen the show as it was going on. And watching a couple of episodes this weekend, the workplace stuff, when it's just about a workplace comedy, is a little hit or miss. But where I like the show a lot is when it starts to butt up against superheroes and considering how it would be to live in this world. And the company that they all work for, you know, it's like a division of Wayne Enterprises that tries to exploit the danger of superheroes for commercial gain, like with security devices and gadgets and things like that, which I thought were pretty clever and funny, the way that they come up with new things that people might actually buy to protect themselves in a world of superheroes. And, you know, it's tough because I do think for a mainstream audience, when people hear superheroes, comic books, they just want the superheroes. But personally, I love this sort of thing, and I enjoy looking beyond the center to see, you know, like you were saying, Alison, the characters, to see how real people, relatable people would live in this world. And I don't think the show Powerless entirely found its footing. Certainly in the couple of episodes I watched, I laughed, but there were definitely some parts that you're like, you know, they hadn't quite found the groove, the characters. But I could definitely see this evolving into something that was really, really smart and sharp and worthwhile. But it's already been canceled, apparently. So that's not going to happen. But you can watch the episodes they did make on Hulu. That is Powerless.
I actually watched all of those.
Oh, you did?
All of the series. I don't think it ever clicked, really.
Right, didn't
it
was quite always, like, get there.
It was always, I think, a little too chipper in tone for...
Yes, it has a very sunny, sort of upbeat, lively...
Right, considering what it's depicting, which is like what it is like to
the
live
drudgery
in a city.
And
also what is like
the
to live
danger.
In a city that is constantly, yes, being partially yes. destroyed.
Clearly it was a choice to be like, these characters, just it's just part of their lives.
Right. I will say this, though. I think it has a really wonderful opening sequence that captures...
The title card?
Yes.
The title credit? I love the
it's
opening
so
credits.
It's so good.
Beautiful.
And I think it captures the kind of, like, that, like, touch of melancholy about
yes.
the basic premise that, like, never really shows up in the show itself.
Yeah, the title... The credits are, like, famous, and especially the opening is the Action Comics number one, the iconic shot of Superman, and then it zooms into this woman in the background, and like, Vanessa Hudgens' name comes up, and then it's... That it continues that way with you know, the comic book fights, and then they zoom in on someone in the background. It's great. Whoever designed them did a fabulous job. I wonder if because it was similar to The Office, they didn't want to go too much like the tone of The Office, and so they tried to be a little more bubbly just to differentiate itself.
I know that there was someone was originally attached to it and left.
Yeah,
it was originally supposed to be like an insurance company that tries to insure and like... In a city that
there was a
getting...
totally different pilot.
Yes.
I know that.
So I mean, I think they tried to. I mean, DC has never done a. This was, I think, they touted it as their first comedy series,
right?
And it, you know, clearly took that. They didn't quite have time to settle in. But I will say, I do love that opening sequence. You can find it.
It's a pleasant show.
You can find it on YouTube if you just want to see that. It is worth checking out. I also picked a TV series for my first recommendation. Both of my recommendations are parodies of superhero genre. I am clearly a little antsy with certain aspects of this genre. So my first recommendation is an anime series called One Punch Man. You can find it on Netflix and on Hulu. Only one season so far, 12 episodes. It is about a 25-year-old superhero named Saitama, He does not have a superhero name, at least not yet. And superheroics are something that's very easy to do in the world of the series, in which monsters and supervillains are constantly attacking. And there is, in fact, a professional organization of heroes with rankings and public profiles. Saitama looks unimpressive. He's actually drawn less detailed most of the time than the other characters. He's bald, has a round head. His face looks somewhere between like the rolling eyes emoji and the neutral face emoji. And his backstory is not very exciting. He took up superheroics for fun. He trained for it by doing a dedicated but like pretty normal workout routine that he reveals as a dramatic secret eventually to a group of unimpressed people. He lives in a very small apartment. He's often seen running errands in normal clothes and lazing around as often as he is in costume fighting evil. And this is the key to the show, he is so inexplicably overpowered that, as the title says, one punch is almost inevitably all it takes to make an enemy explode in a splatter of viscera. Mm. And this depresses him immensely. There are all of these battles that start with this like extremely dramatic, you know, arrival of this giant villain who like delivers a monologue about his motivations and then gets punched once and dies. And so Saitama starts the series experiencing this kind of existential crisis. What does it mean to be a superhero when nothing is a challenge? It's as if Dr. Manhattan from Watchmen were in a comedy fixated on making fun of shonen manga tropes. Everyone else in the series is extremely serious and very monologue prone. In fact, Saitama gains a disciple very quickly, and to his great chagrin, a cyborg teenager named Genos, who's terribly earnest and has a whole backstory involving a doctor who remade him after being attacked and a rival cyborg he wants to fight. And Saitama is greatly disinterested in this. The first season is only 12 episodes, as I said. It does start falling into more conventional territory by even the end of that, but the beginning is pretty wonderful. I do highly recommend the first episode, in the very least, just for the kind of very funny, just deflating of any of the kind of usual grandiose drama of ramping up to a big fight sequence. That is One Punch Man, and it is on Netflix and on Hulu.
Sounds interesting. I'd not only never seen it, I'd never heard of it. It's a good name for a superhero.
Yeah,
it's One Punch Man.
Right? It sounds like a very awkward name, which I think fits him.
Yeah, I like it. Yeah. For my second pick, I went with a movie I've seen many, many times. It's probably my favorite unconventional, quote-unquote, unconventional superhero movie. The other one we have already talked about on the show, so I couldn't pick it. That was Super, which is another unconventional superhero movie that I like.
I really like Chronicle, which I don't know if it's sort of an unconventional superhero movie.
I think so. Yes, I think
but I've talked about it on this podcast as well before.
Yeah, Super, if you want to hear us talk about Super, that was on SVU number 110, which was our controversial comedies episode.
And so, I think I talked about Chronicle back on number 14. Not another teen movie podcast.
I think you could have
probably brought it back
at this point. Yeah.
No.
No.
Must
all right.
Stay pure.
Okay. Fair enough. Well, my second pick is an unconventional superhero movie in a few ways. It is not based on an existing superhero, which I think marks it as unconventional in and of itself. It is also kind of like Split, actually. It treats the idea of being a superhero or having superpowers as something that is more of a curse. It is something that is more of the basis of a horror story than something uplifting or inspiring or to make someone watching it have sort of this escapist feeling. In this movie, the sacrifice involved in the sort of self-sacrifice of all superheroism includes sacrificing the character's body, his face, his life, even his sanity. And the movie is Darkman, directed by Sam Raimi, who, of course, went on to direct the very conventional but very good original Spider-Man movie trilogy. And this film, which he made before it, it's sort of like the gene splice of Evil Dead and Spider-Man, or at least his Spider-Man movies. You have a young Liam Neeson playing the main character, a scientist. He's on the verge of perfecting this synthetic skin capable of making masks so perfect you could pass for anyone alive. Like, I could have an Allison mask and I could walk around and everyone think I was Allison. It'd be great. I wish I could. I could go to BuzzFeed and
imagine
get eat all the free food,
all the free snacks you want.
Oh my God! What a wonderful
soda
world.
Machine.
Yes. Yeah. God, damn. But there's a catch, because the chemical compound of the masks isn't exactly right, And so, do you remember the amount of time that the masks last, Allison, in Darkman?
Oh, God,
99
like,
minutes!
Yeah.
It's such a comic booky concept. 99 minutes they last, and then they break down. And before he can finish his formula, these underworld gangster types blow up his lab with him in it. And so everyone, including his fiance, played by Frances McDormand, think he's dead in this explosion, but he has survived, albeit horrifically scarred, and with his nerves like fried and deadened, which gives him a kind of brilliant low-level superpower. He is so screwed up, he can't feel pain. He can be hurt, he just can't feel it. He's not impervious, he's not invulnerable, but he just doesn't feel it. And over the course of the film, he rebuilds his lab as best he can to try to perfect his masks, hoping that maybe he can use them to get back to a normal life and also use them to get revenge against the mobsters who destroyed his life. And I guess when you say it like that, it is a pretty conventional narrative. What makes it unconventional really is Liam Neeson's manic and borderline psychotic performance and the way that Darkman, which he sort of takes that name up at the end for no real reason, discernible reason, other than it's a superhero movie. At times, he seems less like a hero than a serial killer who just happens to be murdering bad people instead of innocent civilians. And it very much fits in with the Sam Raimi very bleak sense of humor, especially in his early movies, where he would basically just, they're just torturing the protagonists for his own personal and our jollies. And in this moral universe of, I guess, the Raimi-verse, life sucks, and then you get chased by zombies or blown up by gangsters. And so the best thing to do is just to go and embrace it, strap on a chainsaw or a 99-minute mask, and go kick some butt. They did make some sequels to Darkman, direct-to-video, including one of the all-time great direct-to-video titles, Darkman 3, Die, Darkman, Die.
Man, that is something.
That is something, right? And I feel like if the movie was made today, for sure, they would have made a TV show out of it, which would actually be great. I think Darkman would make a great TV show. It seems tailor-made to serialized storytelling, and it's kind of surprising. It hasn't happened yet, actually. But the original movie holds up really well. It is, again, when you were talking, Allison, about how when you're making a movie for $200 million that has to be shown all over the world, you can't take chances, you can't be weird. Darkman is weird, and it's dark in a way that superhero movies, even the supposedly grim ones, are really not allowed to be. You know, dark superhero movies today mean like very attractive people grimacing and screaming and scowling in front of like a cloudy CGI background.
Sure. I will say this, I really like Darkman. I thought of it a bit watching Logan, because Logan, Darkman does something that I kind of wish superhero movies did more, which is to talk about, to have powers come at a cost.
Right.
You know?
Absolutely.
And that in Logan, his, like, enhancements are killing him, basically.
Yes.
It's, you know, and I think that that idea that these powers are not just some incredible enhancement to your life.
Yes.
And then your angst comes separately.
Right.
That
gift
it is,
and curse.
Right.
But more curse.
Right. That there is like a lot of value to that narratively.
Yes.
That just doesn't get, it's a little too grim, I guess, to really get incorporated into
right.
most.
Well, because so many, the ones we see now, the mainstream ones, they're escapist, you know, and there's, that's fun to do. It's fun to imagine, but it's also fun to see someone horribly destroyed by having this happen to them and seeing what they do next. So that's Darkman, which is available right now for rent on all the usual sites.
For my second pick, I went with a movie that I think is particularly pleasurable when you take it in context of the $150 million, $200 million budgets that so many superhero movies encompass these days. It is called Spaghetti Man. And it is available on Amazon Prime and Hulu. This was a 2016 film from Mark Potts, who made this movie with his comedy troupe Heckbender for what looks like maybe $40. I don't think that's really even that much of an exaggeration. It stars Benjamin Crutcher as a fired pizza delivery guy and generally indifferent, unkempt dude named Clark, who lives with a roommate, Dale, played by Winston Carter, who appears to be his only friend. And even he's lucky in that because Dale is also the kind of guy who's willing to cover more than his share of the rent when Clark gets fired. And then Clark is involved with an incident in which there is a bowl of spaghetti and a malfunctioning microwave, a classic origin story, and he wakes up with the ability to shoot strands of spaghetti from his hands, and also to pee spaghetti, though that's less useful.
Okay, yes. Sure.
Dale wants his friend to use his miraculous powers to help humanity. Clark prefers vigilante work for cash. He puts a paper bag on his head as a disguise, stops crime, and then demands payment from the almost victims in a way that sometimes verges on mugging.
Mm-hmm.
There is a touch of Unbreakable to the larger arc that develops when a villain emerges. And I will say this, despite the absurdity, the total absurdity of the premise and the extreme low budget nature of this film, it keeps a pretty straight face as it develops. It does not wink a lot. It understands it as a comedy, but it does not blow up its own premise. Is the acting rough? Sure. Can the action and the production value look a little stilted? Of course, this is an extremely low budget film, but does it ever get less funny when Clark hurls a wad of cooked noodles into someone's face? No.
I mean, I'm laughing just as you describe it.
It is always, always great.
Yeah.
So for just like a totally goofy take on a very expensive genre, I would say look to Spaghetti Man. It is on Amazon Prime and on Hulu.
You have sold me. I am watching this thing.
Oh my God, I'm sorry.
What's going on, Clark?
That came from inside of me.
We gotta take you to a doctor.
I don't want to tell anybody about this.
This could be used for good, maybe.
Now I regret saying anything to you.
That's not what a superhero does.
Who said anything about being a superhero?
You could clean up the streets and beat up bad guys.
Or, I can get paid to punch people.
Who are you?
I'm the Spaghetti Man.
All right, let's talk about some new movies, Allison. Let's not name the segment. We've long since abandoned it.
Yes.
The title
Screw
was unwieldy.
You, long title.
Yes, the new title is Matt and Allison talking about...
Yes. All right, so how about we talk about... Wait, let me get the title correct.
Can you wait? No. Okay, without looking, do you remember the title?
I did. I like laughed when it appeared on screen, but no.
You cannot...
I had to just look it up. King Arthur,
colon,
Legend of the Sword.
I like that you have seen the movie. It has a subtitle.
I didn't
and
even
you could
know.
Not remember
I literally,
it.
Until the subtitle appeared in smaller font next to King Arthur,
that it had
I
a
did
subtitle?
Not know it had a subtitle.
Well, it's very, I'm looking at the poster right now, and it is very, very small, the subtitle. It is like, King Arthur,
Legend of the Sword.
Like, that's how they're sort of marketing it. They don't really want you to think about the subtitle, and I don't know why, frankly, it has the subtitle.
I don't know why either. Are they legally obligated to have a subtitle?
It's possible, because I mean, there was a King Arthur movie called just King Arthur. 13 years ago, something like that. Came out in the mid-2000s. Yeah, so it came out 13 years ago. That was one with Clive Owen and Keira Knightley.
Antoine Fuqua.
This one is Guy Ritchie. I don't think I ever saw the 2003 King Arthur.
If I have, I have
it
long forgotten. It's
long since faded from memory. Much in the way the sword and the stone has passed into legend.
But then, will Legend of the Sword be the definitive King Arthur?
It is sort of a cruelly ironic subtitle, because I have a hard time imagining this movie ever becoming a legend. Maybe people will be like, did that movie exist? Or is this something we heard? I can't imagine this movie being remembered even 6 weeks from now. It's not terrible, I thought.
No, it's just...
It's very professional.
It is like...
It is professionally made.
It's like, what if King Arthur, but sort of Cockney?
What if King Arthur was like vaguely Snatch-like? It's
right.
Guy Ritchie.
It has
the energy, and those are the best sequences.
Absolutely.
It has sequences that feel like one of Guy Ritchie's early crime movies. Everyone's kind of talking very like snarkily with very thick working-class English accents. There's some fun sequences. Like there's a sequence where in this movie, King Arthur is basically like Moses. Like he's like an orphan who's been like thrown in the river and rescued from a basket.
Right. And he grew up as a street urchin.
Right.
In
the mean streets of Londinium.
Yeah.
And we see his childhood in like super fast speed motion, which I thought was cool.
That was clever. Yeah.
Yes. And there are sequences like that, sort of like that also, where they're talking about a heist or a scheme or whatever, and we flash back and forth, just like an old Guy Ritchie movie, from the people talking to what they think is going to happen. And
or
then
what is happening.
Or what is happening. And then someone might say, oh, it's not going to happen like that. This is what's going to, like all that sort of stuff. And all that is really clever and fun. But that's maybe like 15-20% of the movie.
Yeah, there are also, I should point out, characters have names like Chinese George and yes. Backlack and yes. Flat Nose Bill or things like that. No, wait, Goose Fat Bill, Flat Nose yes. someone else. They
yeah, well, it's like you said, like it's King Arthur, but what if or what? But it, but also he knows yeah. MMA because yes. why not? Because there's like a one random Asian guy who can teach him MMA.
Yeah, you never understand what he's
makes no
his,
sense.
What his business is. Yes,
right.
And then by the time this movie gets around to the business of fighting Jude Law yeah. for control of Camelot,
Londinium, Camelot,
it
whatever,
is much less interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it sort of starts with a bang because that is like giant freaking elephants like trashing this citadel.
No, one of my favorite parts of the movie is that it starts off with what is essentially a last time on King Arthur montage, in which it crams all of this stuff involving Eric Bana, Jude yes. Law, war elephants, this bad guy we never see except in flashbacks.
Right.
We see, you know, and it crams all of that into this really expensive looking montage
yeah.
that I think in a lot of other movies would have been just like text on screen.
Yeah.
But yeah. but was not.
There's one super cool visual I thought, which was when when you see how, like, you know, obviously the famous Sword in the Stone, when you see like how the sword got in the stone, and like, well, I thought that was cool. And actually the design of that villain, that bad guy that you're talking about that we see in the flashbacks, I thought he was really cool too.
He looks like he looks like something out of Game of Thrones. There are often moments.
It's very
in
Games
which
of. I mean, to me, it
has
seems like
actors out of Game of
King
Thrones.
King Arthur, but what if Game of Thrones? Like, yes. you could also say it's very clearly inspired by that as well.
Yes.
It's inspired by a lot of things. It's a mishmash. I mean, to me, this it reminded me a lot of the last couple Guy Ritchie movies that he's done, which are like he takes these very famous properties, he kind of keeps them in their period settings, but modernizes the references and the feel and the tone and the editing and the visual effects. You know, Man from U.N.C.L.E. I thought was just like this. It looked great, stylish as heck, professionally made, entirely forgettable.
I enjoyed Man from U.N.C.L.E. more than this, I will say. I think I enjoyed this exactly the same. Had like more of a sense of wholeness, for whatever that's worth, that I think that this or the Sherlock Holmes movies did.
See, I like the first Sherlock Holmes because it had Robert Downey Jr., I thought, giving a really fun performance with Jude Law. Like, the two of them were together were great. And even yes. Man from U.N.C.L.E. has the main guys have chemistry.
Right. Whereas,
here you have Charlie Hunnam, he looks great. My goodness, he's a handsome man. And at least he doesn't have to talk in a horrible American accent, which he does often and almost ruins every single thing he does.
Yes.
He can talk in an English accent, and that is a relief. But he's just not that charismatic, and the guys he's with, he doesn't have a ton of chemistry with.
No, and he doesn't have one kind of person to play off of,
no,
specifically.
That's, to me, where the biggest deficiency compared to those movies is.
Sure.
It's fine.
It's
forgettable.
Yeah, there's nothing special about this. And I am very curious as to how it's going to do, because I do not feel like the world was crying out for another King Arthur reimagining.
I mean, I could be wrong, but I assume it's going to do very poorly, because I don't think anyone cares. Like,
yes.
why would anyone go see it? I don't know. Maybe I'll be wrong. I wouldn't mind if I was wrong. It's fine. I don't expect much.
Yes.
Very quickly here.
Yes.
Because before we speak to our listeners again, a much bigger movie, I think, or more notable, at least, movie is coming out next week, the following week, May 19th. You have seen it. I have not. It is Alien Covenant.
It is Alien Covenant.
This is the latest prequel to Alien, but it's also
a sequel to Prometheus. Yes.
Yes, it's the, yeah, well said. And it is directed by Ridley Scott, who directed the original Alien, did not make any of the sequels, but then came back for Prometheus. So this movie, the early reviews that I've read are very mixed. Some people really like it. Some people really dislike it.
Yes.
Well,
I really like it. I also like Prometheus, so I
yes,
feel like
that's the qualifier that I think needs to be stated. Yes.
I think that this movie, if you are hoping for a return to the original form, the kind of humans versus aliens horror or action movie that were the first two, were Alien and Aliens, you will be disappointed. This movie leans further into the Prometheus themes about creation and God and these origin stories and faith. And I think it pulls it off really well. I think it actually, in fact, I would say clarifies a bit some of these things that I think certain people, like a lot of people, read as annoying in Prometheus, particularly the way the humans are portrayed. I think it kind of clarifies intention a bit more. And it gives a lot of focus to Michael Fassbender, who plays two characters in this, and who is very good. these movies are very kind of like almost operatic and like aim for this grandeur, philosophical grandeur that I understand deeply annoys some people, but that I actually think works really well.
That makes one of us.
Uh-huh. And it definitely, it features incarnations of the aliens.
Okay.
But I don't think, I think for a lot of people, they will not be given enough screen time.
They will be, you're saying there's not enough alien in the movie called Alien Covenant for an audience just looking for aliens.
Yes.
Going to see where they put them on all the posters. It's just the poster is literally a big fat alien face and the title is Alien Covenant. Like that's, and so you're warning our listeners here.
I am warning you.
Yes.
The focus of this movie is at least as much, if not more, about the relationships between synthetics and humans than it is about the relationship between humans and
these
xenomorphs.
Yes. Interesting. All right. Well, that's a helpful note, I'm sure, for our listeners as well. All right. I'm hoping to see it next week. Well, we'll see what happens. I was not a fan of Prometheus necessarily.
Yes.
So you think I won't like it?
I think you will not like it.
All right. Well, we'll find out. All right. Let's get to Behind the Eight Ball, where we wrap things up on every episode of SVU by giving you some new releases on streaming, some listener recommendations that you guys have sent to us at our email address, svu@filmspottingsvu.com, and we also give you one film frozen by my list.
Matt, you want to go first this time?
Sure.
All right. Well, give me three new releases.
First up on Netflix is Anvil, the story of Anvil, a terrific documentary about an obscure heavy metal band from Canada. They're basically the real life Spinal Tap. And this film is a very funny, but also very affectionate, not mocking portrait of the two main guys in the band, Steve and Rob, and their enduring decades-long friendship. I love this movie. I have not had a chance to see it again recently, but I added it to my list myself, just so, like, you know, if I need a pick-me-up coming up in the next couple weeks, I can pop it in just for a few minutes and watch.
It has a fantastic ending.
The ending is one of the all-time great movie endings. I agree with you. Yes, that is Anvil, the story of Anvil. It is available now on Netflix. Next up on Tubi TV is Eight Men Out, John Sayles' drama about the Black Sox scandal of the 19-teens, when members of the Chicago White Sox agreed to throw the 1919 World Series. It has a great cast: John Cusack, Christopher Lloyd, John Mahoney, D.B. Sweeney, David Strathairn, Michael Rooker, and Charlie Sheen, who actually, the people don't know this, he was actually required by law to appear in every baseball movie made in the 1980s.
No.
Either him or Kevin Costner. That was the rule. That was the law.
They had to work hard.
They were very busy. So that's Eight Men Out, and that is available on Tubi TV. Finally, available on Hulu, a documentary that caught my eye that I have not seen, but I'm very curious to check out. I think it's a Hulu original. It's called Batman and Bill. And it is about one of the most important writers of the 20th century whose work is almost universally beloved and yet universally unknown, or at least he is universally unknown. His name is Bill Finger. He is the co-creator of Batman along with Bob Kane, but it's Kane who, you know, I have to see the movie to find out exactly why. He is the one who really got all the credit, all the fame, all the money for the creation of Batman, but it is Bill Finger who worked with him on all of these early issues. He co-wrote or wrote the first script for the first issue of Batman, Detective Comics number 27, and Bill Finger was instrumental in the creation of the Robin and also the Joker. Without Bill Finger, we might not have any of these characters, but his work went unrecognized for decades. And so I'm hoping this story, you know, as I know that, I don't really know the full story. So I'm hoping that this documentary kind of explains it all for me. It's one I'm going to be watching myself. Batman and Bill, available on Hulu.
Okay, how about two listener recommendations?
Our first comes from a longtime listener who I believe we met at our recent live show in Chicago, Jason. He writes, after 50 Shades Darker, allow me to offer some much-deserved Jamie Dornan alternate programming. For those that doubt he has acting chops, you need to check out the Netflix original show The Fall. The show makes Silence of the Lambs look like Silence of the Puppies. There's no cannibalism, but serial killers abound. It's a crime detective drama that is smartly paced and takes place in modern-day Northern Ireland. The last series of the show just wrapped last year, and it's arguable that the very last episode sticks the landing. However, creator Alan Kubit offer some master storytelling all around. You will not regret the shades of gray on display in this show. I see what you did there, Jason. So that is The Fall, And that is a recommendation from Jason. Thank you, Jason. We also got a recommendation from Brian, who writes, I am writing to recommend the documentary Sunshine Hotel, which is now available on Amazon Prime. This is a documentary from 2001 that captures the lives of the men living in one of the last flop houses in the Bowery in New York. These men live in cubicles with chicken wire ceilings. They all arrive there through various combinations of mental illness and substance abuse. It's a fascinating insight into the lives of these men, all of whom are given respect despite their circumstances, as well as the history of New York City. This type of place was already disappearing when the movie was made, and I can only imagine what the neighborhood looks like now. That's the Sunshine Hotel, available on Amazon Prime, and that was a recommendation from Brian. And thank you, Brian. I'm really interested to see this movie because this would have been after the documentary was made, just a couple of years, 2003-ish, I guess. I lived around the corner from the Sunshine Hotel. It was still there at the time. I don't know if it had closed by the time that I had moved, like, 2 years later. So it was the very, very end. I think it did. I'm really interested to watch this now. So I didn't know it existed. I'm going to be checking it out. Thank you, Brian.
Okay, how about one from your My List?
You gave me number 6. And number 6 this time is Trouble with the Curve. The Clint Eastwood movie. He didn't direct it, but he stars in it. Slowed by age and failing eyesight, crack baseball scout Gus Lobel takes his grown daughter along as he checks out the final prospect of his career. I never saw this movie.
I did, and I remember very little about it.
Yes, it was the King Arthur Legend of the Sword of baseball scout movies starring Clint Eastwood. Well, I never saw it, and I saw
Amy Adams.
Amy Adams plays the daughter. Yeah, I saw it popped up on Netflix, and I threw it on there recently because I do tend to like the occasional Clint Eastwood movie, especially when he's old and cranky. It speaks to me. The old cranky guy in deep within my soul. So I added that to my list recently. All right, Allison, are you ready to give us your picks?
No.
Are you ready now?
Okay. Yes.
All right, let's start with 3 new releases.
All right, first up, new to Amazon, Manchester by the Sea. Kenneth Lonergan's Best Picture nominee, starring Casey Affleck, Lucas Hedges, Michelle Williams. Extremely sad, but also pretty funny, which is an aspect of it that I don't think that most people see highlighted. Story about a man who is brought back to his New England town to confront the tragedy that made him leave and to take care of his nephew after the death of his brother. That is on Amazon. And new to Netflix is Don't Think Twice. I did not love comedian Mike Birbiglia's directorial debut, Sleepwalk With Me, but I did love his follow-up, which is a less directly autobiographical but clearly drawn from firsthand experience movie about comedians. It's really a drama, I would say, about comedians, about an improv troupe in New York City. Among the actors playing them, Gillian Jacobs and Keegan-Michael Key. Their space is about to be sold, and each member has to wrestle with whether they're ever going to be more famous, the reality if they're ever going to be more famous or more successful than they already are. Do you love a good movie about dreams dying? It's on Netflix. And finally, also new to Netflix, Things to Come. You know, Isabelle Huppert got a lot of attention for her role in Paul Verhoeven's Elle for understandable reasons, but I would say she is maybe even better in this movie.
Which I definitely like that movie better.
Another 2016 movie directed by Mia Hansen-Love, who did Eden and Goodbye First Love and Father of My Children. In this movie, Huppert plays Natalie Chazot, who is a philosophy professor who, in late middle age, suddenly finds herself kind of losing her husband, her publisher, and a parent, and her kids are off, have already left home, suddenly free from all of these ties and has to reorient herself in life. It's really well done. I love Hansen Love's movies, and this is another very good one. Things to Come on Netflix.
How about 2 listener recommendations?
First up, we have one from Alex who writes, Hey guys, I want to recommend a documentary on HBO called Tickled. The premise is about a gay New Zealand journalist who comes across an online sport called competitive endurance tickling, where young athletic men are on camera tickling each other for money. Yes, this is a real thing on the internet. Anyway, this journalist discovers a dark web of corruption and fear involved with the organization that makes these videos. The documentary starts off as a hilarious curiosity where you think that you're going to be laughing the whole time just because of the absurdity that is guys tickling each other on YouTube. However, it gets very scary and creepy toward the end, and you're left in this total WTF did I just watch state. It is a great documentary that provides the viewer an insight that A, the weirdness of the internet. B, how corruption has no limits, even when it involves tickling. What starts off as a whimsical special turns into a real-life horror movie. I highly recommend checking it out, and everyone I have recommended it to has seen it out of morbid curiosity. Thank you, Alex. I would also recommend Tickled. Have you seen that, Matt?
I have. It's a really interesting documentary.
Yes, it definitely goes places you don't expect.
No, that is 100%. No one could argue with that.
All right. Second recommendation comes from Michelle in Ottawa, who writes, I hope you don't mind me recommending something from what I believe is a Canada-only streaming service called Crave TV. Their focus is on TV shows and documentaries with a great selection of classic TV shows like The Wire, South Park, Seinfeld. They also have a pretty decent lineup of music documentaries, which is where my recommendation of Kurt Cobain, Montage of Heck, comes in. I had been dying to see this film since it came out and was thrilled to randomly find it on Crave a couple weeks ago. The documentary weaves together talking head interviews with key subjects in Cobain's life, like his mother, his pre-Courtney ex-girlfriend, Courtney herself, Novoselic, though curiously no Dave Grohl. With Cobain's artwork, sound collages, and scratchy home recordings, the latter of which are easily the most interesting part of the film and help to paint a portrait of a troubled artist that has been the subject of seemingly endless and conventional behind-the-music docs. Rest assured, this doc is not remotely conventional. I highly recommend it to anyone interested in artist portrait documentaries. And of course, it helps to be a fan of Cobain's work, but is certainly not a requirement. Thank you for that, Michelle. It is available for rent here in the US. It was on HBO Now for a while, but it actually just expired off of that. But you can find it for rent on all the usual platforms. Kurt Cobain, Montage of Heck.
Okay, and how about one film chosen blindly by number from your mileage?
Goosebumps.
Thank you.
You gave me number two. That is Small Crimes. This is a Netflix original movie. It's very interesting to me how much less of a push Netflix has given to its original movies so far. This is another one that kind of got flung out there. It premiered at South by Southwest this year and then kind of got flung out into Netflix, noticed by very few people. It stars Game of Thrones' own Nicholas Coster-Waldau as a disgraced ex-cop who's just been released after a six-year stint in prison for attempted murder. Why it's on my my list is that it's directed by E.L. Katz, who did Cheap Thrills, a film that we both liked.
Really good movie.
Yeah, and it is also co-written by Macon Blair, who's I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore, we talked about on a recent episode, and that also went directly from a film festival, in that case Sundance,
to Netflix.
I think that...
I feel like Netflix could also use the Homer eating the donuts as like a metaphor as well, because they just keep throwing so much content
they
at
do.
You.
And some of it's acquired and some of it's
co-produced.
Right. And I think with the movies, I mean, I think that will certainly shift a bit as they have some big movies coming
out.
Right.
They haven't
this year, but they have not got it down yet where I would say they figured out what to do with original movies yet. But that is available if you're interested. Small Crimes.
All right. Listener choice options for our next episode. We're going all TV. Speaking of new content being shoved down our throats, so we got a lot.
I will say these are all TV with like various film connections, as is the case these days.
That is usually the case these days. Yeah, but we've got three new series on three different platforms, all highly regarded. I guess one of them hasn't quite premiered as we are about to talk about it, but the other two have and gotten incredible reviews. The third one, I know that, well, we'll get to it. Why don't you start? You have the first one.
Okay, first up, your first option is Dear White People on Netflix. This is Justin Simien's Netflix original series adapted from his own acclaimed 2014 film. that was his directorial debut, about the lives of a group of black students attending a mostly white liberal arts college. It is funny. It is a comedy, but also tackles race in America, but also tackles college as a place where you try and hammer out your identity and try on different identities. It's gotten a lot of praise, mm-hmm. and I've heard from some people it's better than the movie, and from other people that it expands, at least it has room to expand on some of the themes that were in the film. So, Dear White People, that's your first option. It is on Netflix right now.
Our next option will be available on Amazon Prime starting on May 12th, although you could watch the pilot right now, and that's the main reason why we're particularly interested in this. It is I Love Dick, created by Jill Soloway, who's also, of course, creator of Transparent. And it tells the story, I'm reading from the Amazon website here, of a struggling married couple, Chris and Silvere, and their obsession with a charismatic professor named Dick, told in Rashomon-style shifts of POV. I Love Dick charts the unraveling of a marriage, the awakening of an artist, and the deification of a reluctant messiah. Not enough deification in television plot synopsises,
never
in my
enough.
Opinion. The main cast is Griffin Dunne, Kevin Bacon as Dick, and the awesome and perpetually underappreciated Catherine Hahn. We talked about the pilot for I Love Dick on SVU number 120. Our main review on that episode was that Amazon pilot season where they do this thing where they show you their pilots, and I guess they let people kind of vote on them or talk about them,
give
feedback. They ultimately decide what gets picked up and not, but it's a way for them to sort of gauge what they have and the appetite for the shows. And I believe this is the first one of that batch to be, at least, I don't know if they picked up all of them. I know they are making The Tick. That was another show, but that hasn't appeared yet. We are getting I Love Dick on May 12th. I have so many TV shows to watch right now that I just don't have, including both of the other shows you're talking about. And some of the other shows that have already come out, like Bosch. I still haven't gotten through
you
Bosch.
I love Bosch.
I love Bosch, and I have no time to watch Bosch.
I already watched Bosch.
You watched the whole season?
Yeah.
Ugh, I'm so jealous. Anyway, but when I saw the Subway ad this week for I Love Dick coming back, I went, oh, I got really excited because I was like, I loved that pilot.
That was a great
pilot. It was a great pilot. We both felt far and away that was the best of those pilots.
Yeah.
And I was like, I can't wait to watch it. And I have no time. But this would give me a good excuse to watch it. So that's option two. I Love Dick, available on Amazon Prime on May 12th.
And your third option is a show that is rolling out, as opposed to the two other streaming services. Hulu drops a few episodes and then does a weekly rollout that is a bit more like traditional television. It is The Handmaid's Tale, the first breakout series for Hulu. Hulu has been experimenting with original programming for some time, but has never had a series that has gotten the kind of attention that this has.
Yeah.
Adapted from Margaret Atwood's 1985 novel of the same name, and brought to the small screen by showrunner Bruce Miller and cinematographer turned filmmaker Reed Morano. She serves as an executive producer and directed the first three episodes, and the show has gotten a lot of attention for its look as well as its frighteningly timely subject matter. Stars Elizabeth Moss, set in a dystopian future shaped by religious fanaticism and a declining birth rate, in which fertile women like Moss's character are assigned as handmaids to elite couples to bear children for them. We could probably arrange to see a bit more of the film or of the show so that we can, you know, talk about it as a larger whole, since I believe four or five episodes are out already. But I, you know, it's a show that's been getting talked about a lot, so I'm sure we would both have a lot to say about that. The Handmaid's Tale on Hulu.
Which movie should we review on the next episode of Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit? Send your pick to SVU at filmspottingsvu.com, or just enter in the poll on our website, filmspottingsvu.com. Your vote must be received by Monday, May 15th at noon. After that, we'll announce the winner on Twitter at our Twitter account, twitter.com/filmspottingsvu. And you'll have all that week to watch the TV show this time and then join us for our conversation on our next episode, which should be on or around Tuesday, May 23rd.
filmspottingsvu.com, newly designed, redesigned, is also where you can find our show archive. And we know we're slowly moving over some of the older episodes. So sorry if you've been tried to find them and haven't been able to yet. We're working on it. You can also find a list of direct links to all the titles we discuss on the episode. The Film Spotting SVU remix theme song is by Vince Vandal. You can find more of Vince's work at vincevandal.bandcamp.com. And we will be back in 2 weeks with more recommendations and the review you pick. And in the meantime, you can always find us on Twitter. I'm at Allison Wilmore. Matt is at Matt Singer. And please do follow the show at Filmspotting SVU. That's where we announce the winner of each listener's choice poll and where I share more streaming suggestions on various platforms and ones that come from you guys, the SVU listeners. For Filmspotting SVU, I'm Allison Wilmore.
And I'm Matt Singer. Thanks for listening.